and welcome to episode 3 of Every Atom. I'm B.
I'm S. Hello.
Thanks for joining us again. Today we're going to start off by telling you about the dance festival that we just got back from called Jamai. Jamai means, it means to handshake. It's a greeting. You say Jamai with someone and then you shake hands. And this festival is a big festival. It's billed as an international festival, although that proved to be somewhat misleading. The international group this year was a Japanese taiko group. Taiko is a form of drumming. We assumed that this group was going to be from Japan. They were from Anchorage, which was a little disappointing. However, they're very good. They were one of my favorite things that we saw. So that was, I guess it was disappointing, but it was also kind of great to see that because it was very interesting. We also got to see a lot of other interesting Yupik dances, different groups from different areas, none of which were really right around here, but several of which were very good and interesting. And then we saw some sort of not so good clogging. I guess they were pretty good at what they were doing, although it wasn't really our thing. But it was fun. A ton of people were there. It's a really big event. There's lots of artisans who come and sell their crafts, dance fans and bracelets, all kinds of jewelry, hats, jackets, parkas. And it was kind of neat to see that. We had to go because we were supposed to do a cultural training at the district office, which was a little strange because it's nearly the end of the year. And it's for first-year teachers, and they don't ask which teachers are coming back next year, so they pay for everybody to come in, even though there's only 8 weeks of school left, and some folks are not coming back. But it was nice to get to the village for a while. It was nice to eat some mediocre Chinese food in a restaurant, buy some food, stay in a hotel, and watch some bad TV, and it was really nice to see some interesting and fun dance.
B mentioned that there's only a few weeks, well, 8 more weeks left of school, and that now's the time when contracts come out. And we got our contract back at the beginning of March, and we have started to let people know that we're not coming back next year. And the first person who we really had to tell was our principal. And that was definitely kind of a difficult conversation. I mean, we've tried to be sort of open-minded all year about the possibility of staying if we really fell in love with this job in this place. But I think we've known most of this year that we were really planning to go back to Portland, which has always felt like our home as long as we've lived there, and which we've missed all year. And I know I've definitely been carrying a little bit of guilt about that, just sort of coming up here to sort of have this adventure, this experience, and, you know, then kind of abandoning the kids, the school. It made it a little bit easier to tell our principal that we were leaving when we found out that he was also thinking of leaving and going to a different village. On the one hand, that made us feel a little bit more comfortable telling him that we were leaving. On the other hand, it kind of made it worse, too, because one of the biggest problems that village schools face is a lack of stability and consistency with the staff, and knowing that, you know, we two are going to be leaving, plus the principal, plus his wife, who's also a teacher. That's a significant portion of the certified staff at the school. But he was very understanding and made it really an easy conversation and offered to write us letters of reference and just in general was pretty awesome about the whole thing. And we've also started to tell the other teachers and the other staff. And, you know, people are generally, I mean, it's not a new thing. I think a lot of Gussics come up here for a year, decide it's not their thing, and go back. It's nothing new for the native people here. Which is one of the reasons I feel kind of bad about it. But everybody's been very understanding, and we're definitely gearing up for the end of the year. It was kind of all of a sudden, you know, we got back from winter break, and it seemed like such a long slog ahead of us, and suddenly there's only 8 weeks left, which mostly I think we're excited about. We miss our friends and Portland so much, and can't wait to be back there. But I know we're both feeling a little bit of sadness about the end of the year approaching, too. Even when you're only in a place for 10 months, I mean, you do form relationships, and most especially with the kids. We just love the kids here so much, and it'll be really sad when the end of the year comes. And saying this kind of goodbye is really different, you know, from when we left Portland, because when we say our goodbyes here, I mean, we can be pretty sure that we'll probably never come back here and never see these people again. And that's a pretty serious goodbye, and I know that will be sad. So we're definitely feeling this mixture of emotions about the end of the year approaching, and it felt really formal, you know, to get our contracts and have to sign our letter of resignation and hand that in. So that was sort of a big thing that's been happening for us recently.
Now on to the quiz question. This week's quiz question is, what is the population density of Alaska? Before you guess, we're going to give you some context. The population density of New Hampshire is 146 people per square mile.
And keep in mind that, you know, New Hampshire's really small, but it's also mostly rural.
The population density of Beaverton, which is a suburb of Portland, is about 4,600 people per square mile. And the population density of Manhattan is 66,000 people per square mile. So, at the end of the podcast, we'll tell you what the population density of Alaska is.
Okay, now we're going to give you a weather report. Today, the weather is -3, but it's quite windy out today, and with the wind chill, it feels like -23. The winds are gusting up to 44 miles an hour. It was really nice out when we left on Friday, so I don't think we realized how cold it was going to get. It was kind of a bumpy plane ride coming back in today, and then when our principal picked us up on the snow machine, Bea and I had to ride back in the sled, and it was a miserable, short, but miserable ride back from the airport back to our apartment. It was bumpy in the sled and so super windy and just freezing. We were just both huddled up with our hoods pulled all the way over our faces to keep the wind out and just holding on, bracing ourselves on the side of the sled so that we didn't get our bones completely rattled over every bump. We had a little string of kind of nice weather. Last weekend we went out for a walk on the ocean. It was really nice out, but it's definitely, the temperature's dropped and it's gotten really windy. The only other thing to say that's sort of remarkable about the weather lately is how quickly the days are getting very long. You know, the equinox was only a little over a week ago, and the daylight is just, we're just gaining so much daylight every week that at this point, I think the sun is coming up a little before 9 is when it starts to get light in my classroom. And I don't know what time sunset is, but it's definitely after 9:30 by the time it really gets dark. And I know that by the time, you know, our last 8 weeks are up and we're ready to go home, that, I mean, I think the sun is not going to be setting till after midnight. So that's going to be kind of exciting to see.
Exciting and also making it difficult to sleep for us and all the students.
Yes, definitely throws you off. You know, you're finishing up dinner, kind of puttering, whatever, getting ready for tomorrow, and you think it's like 7 and you look and it's like, oh, it's 9:30. We have to go to bed. So it definitely throws you off a little bit.
We're going to do the Yupik word now. This time the Yupik word is bumio. Bumio is the word that you say when you're going to do the last verse in a Yupik song. Yupik songs work by repeating the verse and the chorus again and again, 7 or 8 times usually. Usually with it increasing in intensity and speed.
And in volume.
And between the last two verses, the lead drummer will say, bumio. And that's the cue for, this is the last one. During a performance, audience members, after the song is over, audience members can call out, bumio, requesting that they do it one more time. And they're sort of obligated, the dancers and the drummers are obligated to perform that song one more time, at usually the highest level of intensity.
So we're not really sure whether bumio translates to again or last one. But those are the contexts in which it's used, and obviously at the dance festival we heard it a lot this weekend.
Bumio is also the name of a music group that performs traditional Yupik music, and they claim to be the only recording artists to record traditional Yupik music on CD and to release it. They perform all over the world, really. I suspect largely supported by grants. And they're pretty interesting. It's pretty good. It's not like seeing it live, but if you want to get a flavor for it, you can look up bumio. And it's P-U-M-Y-U-A.
Okay, now we're going to move on to reviews. We had sort of a hard time deciding what to review lately because we haven't seen or read anything that's really amazed us lately. But I decided to do my review of a children's book series that I've been using in my class. I'm sure most of you have probably heard of the children's... Well, I don't know. Many of you may have heard of the children's book author Kate DiCamillo. Her most famous book is Because of Winn-Dixie, which has also been turned into a movie. And most of her books are like kind of for older children, maybe like 4th, 5th grade. And they're really wonderful, I think, the ones that I've read anyway. But she started writing a series for younger kids. I think the first one came out in 2005, but I only discovered it this year. And the first one's called Mercy Watson to the Rescue, and it focuses on this main character, Mercy Watson, who's actually a pig, but lives in the home of this couple, the Watsons, who basically treat her, you know, like a very spoiled child. And they're really funny. They're very comical. And what I really love about them is that they look and feel and read like chapter books, but they have these wonderful illustrations, and they're really simple, and there's lots of illustrations. So I have several kids in my class who, you know, are reading well below grade level and are kind of reluctant readers, and they absolutely love these books. So if you have a sort of a young reader, a new reader, or an older reader who's not a very good reader or who's sort of, you know, a reluctant reader, I'd really recommend checking out this series. I think there's 6 of them so far, and the humor is very kind of slapstick and silly, and the pictures kind of add to that. You know, they're sort of dramatic and overdone, but it's really a well-done series, and my kids have been enjoying it a lot.
I'm going to review a book that I finished a couple weeks ago called Raven's Children. It's by Richard Adams Carey. The subtitle is An Alaskan Culture at Twilight, and I actually referred to the book in the interview with our fearless leader. Although I can't recall if I mentioned that in the part that you're going to hear in that interview later on in this podcast or in the previous part that you heard last time in episode 2. Regardless, it's a book written by a former teacher in one of the villages in our district. The book was published in 92. So older in some ways, but one of the more recent books that you can find that is so specific with regard to what's going on for us. And it really gives a pretty good idea of what it's like to live in a Yupik village these days. It follows one family. The author lives with this family over the summer, and really particularly follows the patriarch of the family, Oscar Active, and his struggles in transitioning from finding his role as a male in Yupik society as it collides with broader U.S. culture. He has to fish. He's a commercial fisherman, so that they can make money and eat, but his wife makes the majority of their money by being the secretary at the school. So his role is necessary, but perhaps not as necessary as his wife's, and that is a flip of the traditional roles as far as providing for the family goes. And he struggles with that, and he struggles with alcoholism, and he struggles with keeping his family together, especially his extended family. His brothers and his father struggle with alcoholism, and they struggle with the fishing. He sold his license at one point, so he has to depend on his brother to go fishing with him. And it's an interesting read. It's not super well written, but it's the best book that I've read that gives an idea of the struggle that folks in these sorts of villages face, and sort of intimate portrayal of family life. So if you're really interested in finding out more about what it's like, you can give that book a read. It might be a little bit difficult to find, although I'm sure Amazon carries it. Just might not be in your local library. So Raven's Children by Richard Adams Carey.
Well, in episode 2, we didn't dip into the mailbag at all, but we're going to return to that part of our podcast now. And for the mailbag today, what you're actually going to hear is a sort of a montage. About a month or so ago, I had my students write letters to my former students back in Oregon. I thought it would be fun for them to get a letter back from someone who lives in such a different place and is a pretty good friend of mine who now teaches those kids. So I emailed her and said, would you be into this? And she was. So I have the letters that my children wrote to their prospective pen pals. And so we're going to kind of trade back and forth, B and I, and just read you little bits and pieces, kind of our favorite pieces of the letters that my kids wrote. And just to give you an idea, these kids are anywhere between 9 and 13 years old, and they, you know, are reading and writing anywhere from a second to a fourth grade level. And there's 6 different letters that you're going to hear right now. And the kids often mention where they live, but obviously we're not going to say the name. You'll just hear us say the village, as we always refer to our village here. So, here we go. I live in the village. There are dangerous foxes and dogs. I got bitten by one. Its name is Puppy. I saw a walrus. People like to hunt seals, caribou, ducks. What is your favorite food? Mine is pizza. I broke my wrist. I fell off a cargo. I didn't cry. I don't cry anymore.
My favorite animals are little wolves and fox and dogs and lion and a bear and panda. I live in the village. There are wolves. We hunt birds and duck and goose and black bear.
What time does school start? I love to travel. I really love to shower. My birthday is on March 13th. I live in the village. I love to slide. We have lots of foxes here. We have a native store. I love to clean up. We have an ocean. I love to go to the store. We live by the river.
It's beautiful in the village. There are different animals here, like fox, muskox, fish, seal, and wolf. Our school is big. Did you ever eat fish before? Did you go hunting before?
My cat is black and white, and my favorite dog is brown dog and light brown dog. And my favorite animal is a muskox. And I love to fish, I love to play outside, I love to check the teachers at BIA. The people go to the post office. There is dogs in the village. People go fishing at the ice and they catch fish. The people go to store to buy food. People go hunting and catch seals. And people wake up and people go to school. What is your dad's name? What is your mom's name?
I live in the village. My favorite colors are blue, pink, black, and purple. I wash my hair every Sunday. That does it for the mailbag. We're going to move on to the second half of the interview. Again, the first half we played in the previous podcast, and you might want to check that out if you haven't already. So this part is the second half of our interview with the principal, whom we refer to as our fearless leader. I had a few, I mean, turn towards, I don't know, maybe more serious again. Often S and I and sometimes our friend E sit around thinking about the villages, and we're always talking about the school, and often... often talking about what's been difficult. So I guess one question is, since you've lived in a few other villages, how did the problems in this village compare to other villages? Are they worse? And if they're worse, why? And if they're not worse, then I guess that'd be interesting to hear.
I've given this a lot of thought lately, too, because the last few months seem... more difficult than the previous 2.5 years I've been here. And I would have to say that the challenges we're facing in this community are worse than some of the challenges I've faced in other communities that I've lived in. Of the two other communities I've lived in, one was comparable in size. The other was almost twice as large. So the large village was hard to kind of get a gauge on what really was going on because there were so many people, it was hard to get that those kinds of relationships. So I was only there for a year. The other village, I lived there for 5 years and had, you know, established myself in the community and was, I think, I'd like to think at least, well-liked. And they had some serious problems. We used to joke when we were teachers... at that school, we used to joke that the town's nickname should be Dysfunction Junction. If that were Dysfunction Junction, I'm not sure what I would call what's going on here. You know, in that town, alcohol would show up, if it showed up once a month, that was a lot. Usually it was like you'd see a lot of alcohol around permanent fund check time, and then again during April where tax refunds would come in. And that was it. This town, I hear or see about alcohol being either brewed or consumed almost every single week. And the amount of marijuana that's in this village is just crazy. The kids are getting it on a regular basis. I had two kids in my office the other day tell me they're smoking two or three times a week. And to be honest, I think the government of this community has struggled for the last 20 years. They were having some kind of war between the two governing bodies. And so because of that, they were not able to reach agreements that brought services to the community the way other villages had services brought in. For example, the other community I lived in the last decade, they have been able to get a brand new fuel tank, a brand new airport, a brand new sewer lagoon, a brand new water and sewer system. They're working on flushing toilets and running water for half of the village. They've got a fisheries resource building along with a brand new school, and now five wind turbines going up. And that's literally probably something in the neighborhood of $50 million or even $75 million worth of projects and infrastructure brought into that community. And like I said, they're about the same size as ours. Yet, in the same time in our village, you see none of that. We have a sewer system that was begun, and then the funding ran out because the community couldn't agree on stuff. So now we have people that still use flush and haul systems. We still have people hauling their own feces in 5-gallon honey buckets. Some of them still taking it out onto the ocean ice and dumping it into the ocean. So a lot of the services that I think, you know, should be here for a community of this size aren't here. And, you know, that in and of itself is a troubling thing. But then when you compound it with all of the abuse and alcohol and drugs, I think, my assessment would be this is a more challenging community than the others that I've lived in.
Could you run briefly through how governance in a village like this works? Because I wouldn't know how to explain it.
Well, most of the communities have a corporation, okay? And the corporations were formed as a part of Anilka, the Alaska Native Land. Oh, gosh.
Is that the Native Claims Settlement Act?
Yeah, that's ANCSA, uh-huh. And then Anilka followed it, but uh-huh. they're related anyway. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as a result of the Land Claims Settlement Act in 71, they formed these village corporations, like in our community and all the other communities, and then they also formed the 13 regional corporations around the state. The local corporations generally run, you know, some of the facilities here, like ours runs the one store, and then they sell the gas and stuff. Now, they're governed by the local council. They have an IRA, what's called an IRA council, and many of the communities have an IRA council. And I'm not entirely sure how those fit in the hierarchy of the state government as well, or federal government. I don't quite understand how that fits all in together. And in our community, for many years, we also had a traditional council or a tribal council. And so one was recognized by the state, one was recognized by the feds. When money was getting funneled into the community, the two groups would argue over who got the money and who got the, you know, got to oversee the implementation of the plans. Some of them are ceded. One of them was ceded certain property and land here among the community. The other one had different land, you know, and so that's been an ongoing battle. And because they never really resolved anything, you know, I know that my first year here, we had just lost like $1.8 million in federal or state aid for our sewer system because they couldn't come up with an agreement over the land use between the two organizations.
And then last question, unless you have something else?
Well, go ahead.
I think the last question about the future of this village. Sometimes we sit around and we're talking after we eat dinner and wondering what is the future going to be? And, you know, reading a book right now about a village, the subtitle is Twilight of Alaskan Culture, I think, or the Twilight of Yupik Culture. And that was written 30 years ago or 25 years ago. Sometimes I think, well, this can just sort of go on as it is forever. And sometimes I think villages like this are not going to last. It's going to end. So I don't know.
Well, and just to give a little bit more context, I mean, from our very limited perspective, having only been here, you know, a handful of months, it seems like we've entered into a culture that's in the midst of essentially dwindling down to nothing. It seems that the language is being lost. It seems that the traditional ways of gathering food are being lost. It seems that the traditional values are being subsumed by Western values. And it's hard to know how much of that is... It seems that way to us just because we really haven't been here very long and we don't know that much about it. So, you know, you've been here much longer, and I guess I think we're asking for your broader perspective on that.
Sure. I think people have been coming out here for 40 years working in education or as missionaries, and they've all had the same kind of view that these communities are going the way of the dodo and they'll just fall off the face of the earth and cease to exist. And I don't see that happening. As much as I would like to see things happen differently, as much as I would like to see these problems we just talked about go away or be solved somehow quickly, you know, in reality, it's not going to happen quickly. But at the same time, you have to understand the context. It's 2010. 160 years ago, 1850 or so, no one in this area had even seen a white person. Or if they had, it had been a Russian. And so in 160 years, they've gone from never having seen a non-native person to cell phones and internet, South Park and Beavis and Butthead, you know. Even as little as 30 years ago, in the 1980s, like a community like this would have had one phone in the entire community. And when someone got a phone call, they would then get on the VHF radio and tell that person they had a call, and the person had to walk down to the place where the phone was and answer the phone. It could be a mile from one end of the village to the other, you know. So things have been changing dramatically. Some of the elders we have in our community right now are some of the last to have actually grown up living in the old sod guzyaks, the mud houses. When they die, that knowledge, a lot of that knowledge will die with them. But I guess it's my belief that the communities themselves have been adapting to the new technology, rifles, 18-foot lund boats, machine-made nets and machine-made clothing for 150 years. And they're going to continue to adapt. And I don't believe that the culture itself will die or that the villages themselves will disappear. I think that they'll change and adapt. And my hope is that they can find a balance between the traditional and the modern. I strongly believe that education is the means to find that balance. If you have people in the communities that are educated, that can handle the kind of Western bureaucracy that is needed to bring the services to the community, then the communities can become more self-sustaining. They can return to a kind of balanced, a balance between subsistence and cash economies. Right now, we don't have that. Right now, we have a cash economy with subsistence activities, but the people still believe they have a subsistence lifestyle. So I think there's just a kind of mind shift or, you know, mental shift that needs to go on, but once they get there, they can find the balance between the two worlds. At least that's what I hope.
Well, I was going to say that I didn't want that to be the last question because I swear that was going to be a really depressing answer, and I wanted to ask one more question and leave things on a positive note, but I actually think that's a really nice place to leave things.
I agree. Yeah.
That was a much more hopeful answer than I predicted, so maybe we'll leave it right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
okay, we're going to tell you the answer to our quiz question. Remember, the question was, what is the population density of Alaska? Well, I hope as you were thinking about this, you kept in mind that Alaska is by far the biggest state in the U.S. It's approximately one-third the size of the rest of the continental United States. And there's not very many people who live here, approximately, I think, 600,000 or 700,000, most of whom live in Anchorage or Juneau. That's a long way of saying that the population density is very low. It's 1.2 people per square mile. Of course, as you obviously know, population density doesn't work like a grid, so it's not that there are 1.2 people in every square mile of Alaska. It's more that there are pockets of places where people tend to group up, and most of the state is completely uninhabited. And you really get a feeling for that when you fly from, say, the district office in Athol to out here in the village, where between those two places you pass maybe two or three villages of, you know, 200 to 300 people, but most of what you fly over is just utterly immense and utterly empty. It's pretty mind-blowing when you've grown up in the lower 48 and you don't really see places like that very often, especially having grown up in the Northeast where it's pretty dense.
That's all for this episode of Every Atom. We hope to be back in a couple weeks with another episode. Of course, our couple of weeks is usually a few weeks, and our few weeks is often 6 or 7 weeks, so we'll see.
We'll try.
So thanks for listening, and we'll hopefully see all of you who are listening to this very soon.
Bye.